there's a single word that defines, I think, what we're about to read and examine, it's got to be Jubilee. Now, this is the place in the Torah where we receive instruction on that somewhat mysterious year of Jubilee. Most of us have heard about it. We usually don't quite understand what it's all about. Yet, we have to know that while Jubilee is the formal name for a special one-year time period event that comes every 50 years, from the Torah standpoint, it's not a year of celebration and festivity and plenty, like the name implies. It's actually kind of somber in its tone. Now, for some folks, it was a most welcomed time. For others, it was a severe interruption in their lives. It carried with it not just a little bit of discomfort and inconvenience. It also included some loss of personal prosperity as well. Now, this 25th chapter of Leviticus contains a lot of civil law regarding property, and particularly when property is either land or slaves. So this is important for us to understand for a couple of reasons. First, it's important that we understand the backdrop of the times. And second, it contains patterns and principles that not only give us direction on how we ought to think and behave as concerns property, but also on certain functions and purposes of the Messiah. Now, this is a pretty long chapter. It gets rather detailed in its legal definitions. So what I prefer to do is to read it all in order so it's tied together. Then we're going to reread a few sections as we discuss them a little bit more thoroughly. So open your Bibles to Leviticus chapter 25. If you have a complete Jewish Bible, it's page 139. We're going to read the whole chapter, and it's fairly long. Adonai spoke to Moshe on Mount Sinai, and he said, "Tell the people of Israel, when you enter the land I'm giving you, the land itself is to observe a Shabbat rest for Adonai. 6 years you'll sow your field, 6 years you'll prune your grapevines and gather your produce, but in the 7th year it's to be a Shabbat, a Sabbath of complete rest for the land. A Sabbath for Adonai. You'll neither sow your field nor prune your grapevines. You are not to harvest what grows by itself from the seeds left by your previous harvest. You are not to gather the grapes of your untended vine. It's to be a year of complete rest for the land. But what the land produces during the year of Shabbat will be food for all of you. You, your servant, your maid, your employee, everyone, anyone living near you. Your livestock, the wild animals on your land, everything the land produces may be used for food. Now you are to count 7 Sabbaths of years, 7 times 7 years, that is, 49 years. Then on the 10th day of the 7th month on Yom Kippur, you are to sound a blast on the shofar. You are to sound the shofar all throughout your land, and you are to consecrate the 50th year, proclaiming freedom throughout the land to all of its inhabitants. It will be a yovel, a jubilee for you. You will return everyone to the land he owns, and everyone is to return to his family. That 50th year will be a yovel, jubilee for you. And in that year, you are not to sow or harvest what grows by itself or gather the grapes of untended vines, because it's a yovel. It will be holy for you. Whatever the fields produce will be food for all of you. In this year of Jubilee, every one of you is to return to the land he owns. Now, if you sell anything to your neighbor or buy anything from him, neither of you is to exploit the other. Rather, you are to take into account the number of years after the Jubilee when you buy land from your neighbor. He's to sell to you according to the number of years crops that will be raised. If the number of years remaining is large, you'll raise the price. If few years remain, you lower it. Because what he is really selling you is the number of crops to be produced. Thus, you're not to take advantage of each other, but you are to fear your God, because I'm Adonai your God. Rather, you are to keep my regulations and rulings and act accordingly. If you do, you will live securely in the land. The land will yield its produce. You'll eat until you have enough. You'll live there securely. And if you ask, if we aren't allowed to sow seed or harvest what our land produces, what are we going to eat in the seventh year? Then I will order my blessing on you during the sixth year so that the land brings forth enough produce for all 3 years. The eighth year, you will sow seed, but eat the old stored produce until the ninth year. That is, until the produce of the eighth year comes in, you will eat the old stored food. The land is not to be sold in perpetuity, because the land belongs to me. You're foreigners, temporary residents with me. Therefore, when you sell your property, you must include the right of redemption. That is, if one of you becomes poor and sells some of his property, his next of kin can come and buy back what his relative sold. If the seller has no one to redeem it, but becomes rich enough to redeem it himself, he will calculate the number of years the land was sold for, refund the excess to its buyer, and return to his property. If he hasn't sufficient means to get it back himself, then what he sold will remain in the hands of the buyer until the year of Jubilee. In the Yovel, the buyer will vacate it. The seller will return to his property. If someone sells a dwelling in a walled city, he has 1 year after the date of sale in which to redeem it. For a full year, he'll have the right of redemption. But if he has not redeemed the dwelling in the walled city within the year, then title in perpetuity passes to the buyer. Throughout his generations, it will not revert in the Jubilee. However, houses in villages that aren't surrounded by walls are to be dealt with like the fields in the countryside. They may be redeemed before the Jubilee, and then they revert in the Jubilee. Concerning the cities of the Levites and the houses in the cities that they possess, the Levites are to have a permanent right of redemption. If someone purchases a house from one of the Levites, then the house he sold in the city where he owns his property will still revert to him in the Jubilee. Because the houses in the cities of the Levites are their tribe's possession among the people of Israel. The fields and the open land around their cities may not be sold, because that is their permanent possession. Now, if a member of your people has become poor, so that he can't support himself among you, you're to assist him as you would a foreigner or a temporary resident, so that he can continue living with you. Do not charge him interest or otherwise profit from him, but fear your God, so that your brother can continue living with you. Do not take interest when you loan him money, or take a profit when you sell him food. I'm Adonai, your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt in order to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. If a member of your people has become poor among you and sells himself to you, do not make him do the work of a slave. Rather, you are to treat him like an employee or a tenant. He will work for you until the year of Jubilee. Then he'll leave you, he and his children with him, and return to his own family and regain possession of his ancestral land. For they are my slaves, whom I bought out of the land of Egypt. They are not to be sold as slaves. Don't treat him harshly, but fear your God. Concerning the men and women who you have as slaves, you are to buy men and women slaves from the nations surrounding you. You may also buy the children of foreigners living with you, and members of their families born in your land. You may own these. You may also bequeath them to your children to own. From these groups you may take your slaves forever, but as far as your brothers, the people of Israel, are concerned, you are not to treat each other harshly. If a foreigner living with you has grown rich, and a member of your people has become poor and sells himself to this foreigner living with you or to a member of this foreigner's family, he may be redeemed after he's been sold. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle's son may redeem him. Or any near relative of his may redeem him. Or if he becomes rich, he can redeem himself. He will calculate with the person who bought him the time from the year he sold himself to the year of Jubilee. And the amount to be paid will be according to the number of years and his time as at an employee's wage. If many years remain, According to them, will he refund the amount of his redemption from the amount he was bought for? If there remains only a few years until the year of Jubilee, then he will calculate with him. According to his years, will he refund the amount of his redemption? He will be like a worker hired year by year. He will see to it that he's not treated harshly. If he has not been redeemed by any of these procedures, nevertheless, he will go free in the year of Jubilee, he and his children with him. For to me, the people of Israel are my slaves. They are my slaves whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. I am Adonai, your God. But let's begin by trying to assess this from an overall standpoint, because it's pretty complex. The focal points of Jubilee are restoration and mercy in a supreme divine demonstration of God's grace towards his people. Now, of course, this involves parallel acts of restoration and mercy by his people. In other words, in the Jubilee, God has made an ordinance and he demonstrates his attributes of perfect and ideal justice and fairness and equality and mercy and redemption. But, as are all of his laws, this law of Jubilee is not to just kind of float around as an ideal or for us to contemplate and then feel all warm and fuzzy about it. This law is to be physically observed. It's to be manifested on earth. It's to be lived out and carried out by his people for the benefit of his people. Truly, the law of Jubilee is one of the best examples we have in the Bible of the foundation that undergirds each of God's 613 laws. You shall love Yehovah your God with all your mind, soul, and strength, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. One of the primary ways that this restoration and this mercy inherent in the Jubilee year are carried out is by means of the regulations and the ordinances concerning real property rights that are established here in Leviticus 25, both from the standpoint of what is best for a clan or a family collectively, that meaning a family unit, but still protecting an individual as well. Another primary purpose of these Jubilee laws was to assure that any reasonably diligent man who found himself and or maybe his family in poverty for any number of reasons could get a new start, could get a new lease on life from time to time. And the opportunity for this new start came on the God-established Jubilee once every 50 years. Now, the usual reason that a person was in debt in those days was due to poverty. Debt was not seen as something usual or normal or casually entered into. And for the Hebrew, the typical reason that many poor folks wound up in indentured servitude to another Hebrew was due to a debt he couldn't repay. Those among us who have experienced the seemingly unbreakable cycle of borrowing and getting into debt only to discover we can't pay that debt, so then we borrow more to pay the previous debt, only under even more onerous conditions and terms, which of course we can't repay either, we understand this bottomless pit. There seems to be no way out. And thus we live our lives under this crushing burden of debt until we become bankrupt. But most debt in Western society isn't forced upon us from need. Rather, it's a choice that comes from our wants and our desires. Impatience to have what one wants immediately. A bigger, newer car, a bigger, nicer house, more clothes, more digital toys and gadgets, more entertainment. And most of this debt is either in the form of what is called unsecured debt, meaning credit cards, or it's under secured debt, meaning our homes or our cars. And if we default on our home mortgage, what happens? We lose our home. If we default on our car loan, repossessed. All debt in the Hebrew system was secured debt. All of it. And almost always the means of collateral was land, since it was an agricultural-based society. Lose the land, you not only lose your home, you lose your food supply. You lose the ability to generate income in order to buy other things you need that you can't produce on your land. The other kind of security for debt in the Bible era was yourself or a family member. Thus, the concept is born of indentured servitude. A human being becomes the collateral for a loan. The year of Jubilee was partly designed to deal with this everyday reality for the people of Israel. Now, we possibly have some folks listening who come from farming backgrounds. So it's a little easier for you to understand the preeminent place the possession of land owned by the family holds in an agricultural society. Israel, throughout their entire history, was an agricultural society. So we see the chapter open with God speaking to Moses concerning the land that he was giving, or better, he'd already given, to the Israelites, the land of Canaan. Now, I've often used the analogy that as we learn Torah, it's organized in a kind of way like the maturing process that takes place in a human. We begin life learning general and rather simplistic rules and facts about a variety of topics. And as we absorb those things, and then as our minds are able, more information is added. A finer point is put onto each matter. Pretty soon, we see certain subtle connections and commonalities between what at first seemed to be totally separate issues. Then layers of the onion are peeled back even further to reveal deeper intricacies of the world around us. Later in life, a lot of things that we thought we understood, that we thought we knew, we thought we knew everything about it, all of a sudden it starts to make sense on a deeper level. And so we gain what the Bible calls wisdom, as opposed to just knowledge or just a whole bunch of facts. We were introduced to the basics of God's laws in Exodus. Next, the initial parts of Leviticus gave us more information about those basic laws of Exodus, so that God's intent behind each of these commandments and laws could be better grasped. Later in Leviticus, specific topics of which we had already been introduced are addressed again. Nuances then are put into certain of the God principles. And as we get into Numbers and then finally into Deuteronomy, we'll get even more instructions that connects these dots in order to get a more complete picture for those who have slogged their way through the first three books of the Torah. Well, here in Leviticus 25, we're like a student in their senior year in college. And now that we've established a good, solid base of knowledge, and we've had terms defined and examined, certain matters of special importance to God are going to be discussed, but in more detail. And one of those details is this. While it is true that God gave the land of Canaan to Abraham, it was not an outright transfer of ownership the way we would think of it. Rather, God has retained the ownership of Canaan and instead given Abraham's seed, Israel, a long-term lease. A forever lease, actually. Although temporary eviction for breaking the lease terms is also part of the deal. And as in verse 2 of our current chapter, where it says, when you enter this land I am giving to you, let's look at the Hebrew word used for giving. And that word is natan, Nathan. Yeah, Nathan, just like the name of the prophet who served King David. And the sense of this word is something like this: bestowed, given, added to you, apportioned to you. It's a gift. It's something assigned to you, set apart for you. In other words, Nathan doesn't so much indicate a transfer of ownership as something being, as it does something being given to you to use, as though it were yours, but it's not yours. It's like being president of the United States. You don't own the presidency. Some might think they do, but it belongs to the people. Rather, each president is just holding the office for a time. This is why I make the analogy of the land being given to Abraham as a lease, not a sale. God retained ownership. Israel got the use of it. Now, as undergraduate students studying the Torah, it's important that we understand this critical biblical principle of land tenure. And it is possessing something that's not necessarily yours to own. What Israel held in Joshua's day, what it holds today, is not perpetual ownership. They have a perpetual lease. Big difference. And in Hebrew, this key principle is called achuzah, achuzah, which means holding. And Yehovah tells Israel that since you don't own the land, you just have a leasehold, so you can't sell property. Why can't you sell property? You don't own it. Any of us who have ever leased a building or a house, we understand that. We can use that property without interference from the owner as long as we honor the terms set forth in that contract. But the one thing we can't ever do is sell it, because we don't own it. Further, one of the key terms of the leasehold agreement, expressed in the covenants of Abraham and Moses, concerning the land that they're going to possess, is that Israel is only to make the land itself work and produce for 6 out of every 7 years. Just as Yehovah worked for 6 days when he created our universe and then ceased on the 7th day, so the Israelites must ask the land to work for 6 years and then allow it to cease working in the 7th year. This Shabbat was not for the Israelites, per se. It was for the land, because so the land could rest. Let's reread a short portion of this now. We're going to reread 25, 1 through 7. We go through some of these complexities. Adonai spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, and he said, "Tell the people of Israel, when you enter the land I am giving to you, the land itself is to observe a Sabbath rest. 6 years you'll sow your field. 6 years you'll prune your grapevines and gather the produce. But in the 7th year, it's to be a Shabbat of complete rest for the land, a Shabbat for Adonai. You will neither sow your field nor prune your grapevines. You are not to harvest what grows by itself from the seeds left by your previous harvest. You're not to gather the grapes of your untended vine. It's to be a year of complete rest for the land. But what the land produces during the year of Shabbat will be food for all of you. You, your servant, your maid, your employee, anyone living near you, your livestock, pardon me, and the wild animals on your land, everything the land produces may be used for food." Okay, so for 6 years, the Israelites are to till the land, sow it, care for it, and harvest its produce. They're to prune the vines, partake of its fruit, but in the 7th year, called the sabbatical year, Israel is to do nothing with the land. They could not sow. They could not prune their vineyard. Now, pruning was key for maintaining the health and the productivity of grapevines. In fact, there were 2 prunings per year, one in the summer, the other in the winter. None of that could occur in the Sabbath year. Now, even though the 50-year Jubilee cycle is the ultimate subject of Leviticus chapter 25, first a foundation for understanding it and then connecting it with God's Sabbath pattern is established for us. So the concept of the Sabbath year is discussed. Verses 5 through 7 are a bit difficult to understand because it seems on the one hand to say that during the seventh year Sabbath, one must not harvest and eat what grows up naturally from the untended field. And then the other one says you can harvest whatever the land produces by itself. So we have to seek out the ancient sages to give us some good answers to this conundrum. They tell us that these are two different situations. It was common for grain to have seeds fall off when it ripened, and then for those seeds to germinate on their own and produce new grain stalks. But it was also common to cut grain stalks and then have them send up new shoots from their existing roots and then produce more grain stalks. In the first instance, this was considered new grain because it came from seeds. In the second instance, this was considered old grain because it came from the roots of existing plants. This situation was so common and understood that names were given to this second growth and even a fairly usual third growth that came from the same plant roots. The second growth was called in Hebrew Safiach, and in the third growth, Shachis. And this rule of Adonai 25 is that in the sabbatical year, one could not harvest and eat what came from seeds, but one could harvest and eat the second and third growth that came up from existing root systems. But verse 7 again brings to the fore the principle that in the land of Israel, there's no second-class citizens. Whether foreigners staying among the Hebrew slaves purchased by the Hebrews or indentured servants, it didn't matter. Everyone who lived as Israel shared and shared alike in whatever was produced on the land in that sabbatical year. Now, one point we need to be aware of. I said that the Shabbat year, the sabbatical year, was for the benefit of the land, not the Hebrews. And while true, the other idea here was in the sabbatical year, the Hebrews were now fully dependent on God to provide for them. What was being demonstrated to the Israelites was that in the end, it wasn't their labors that brought forth food from the ground. It was just a gift from God. Israel was again almost as nomads during the seventh year, such as they were for 40 years in the wilderness. They were fully dependent on the Lord for their sustenance. If God didn't provide it, they didn't eat it. So a great deal of faith was required on the part of these Hebrews as the sabbatical year rolled around. And of course, since God did provide it, it would serve to build a trust in Him. Well, let's reread a little bit more of Leviticus 25. We're going to read 8 through 13. You are to count 7 Sabbaths of years, 7 times 7 years, 49 years. Then on the 10th day of the 7th month on Yom Kippur, you are to sound a blast on the shofar. You are to sound the shofar all throughout your land. You are to consecrate the 50th year, proclaiming freedom throughout the land to all of its inhabitants. It is a yovel, a jubilee for you. You will return everyone to the land he owns. Everyone is to return to his family. That 50th year will be a jubilee for you, and in that year you're not to sow, harvest what grows by itself, or gather the grapes of untended vines, because it's a jubilee. It will be holy for you. Whatever the fields produce will be food for all of you. In this year of jubilee, every one of you is to return to the land he owns. In verses 1 through 7, it was a reminder of the requirement for a seventh year complete rest for the land. Now that the Sabbath year principle is established, now this so-called yovel, jubilee, is ordered. Now, a rather standard A biblical term is used to explain the time frame for the Jubilee. It's to be seven Sabbaths of years, or 7 weeks of years, seven times seven. By the way, you can hear that term a lot later on, particularly in Daniel. Then, after that 49 years, begins the Jubilee year on the 50th year. The mark of the start of this special 50th year is the occasion of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the 10th day of Tishri, which by the Hebrew religious event calendar is the 7th month of the year. Now, this might seem a little bit odd, because we have the beginning of the 50th year delayed by 10 days from when it would seem logical that it ought to start. Because the first day of Tishri is Rosh Hashanah, Jewish New Year. Yet because the actual Hebrew word for Jubilee is Yovel, which means ram's horn, and the ram's horn is associated with Yom Kippur, then the year of Jubilee didn't begin until the 10th day of the month of Tishri, which is Yom Kippur. And frankly, not all Jews even agree with the rationale behind this. And this 50th year Jubilee is to be a sabbatical year, just as each seventh year is to be a sabbatical year. Now, watch as the prophetic meaning of the Jubilee starts to unfold. The 50th year, of course, connects with the 50th day of Pentecost, Shavuot. The Lord told Israel that if they didn't observe the 50th year Jubilee, they would be exiled from their land, and foreigners, Gentiles, would enjoy what the Lord had intended for his own people, Israel. Of course, that's what happened on more than one occasion. So this dovetails perfectly with Pentecost, the 7 weeks of days plus one, 50 days. On the 50th day, the Holy Spirit descended not just for Jews, but for Gentiles. Foreigners who'd never been part of Israel could suddenly know God's saving provision, Yeshua. God's provision would be for everybody who believed, including those who weren't part of physical national Israel. Those who did not observe the provisions of the 50-year Sabbath cycle, the Jubilee year, however, we're told would be cut off from their land. Those who did not observe the provisions of Pentecost, acceptance of the Holy Spirit, who came on the 50th day, those will be cut off from the kingdom of God. See the parallel? The 50-year Jubilee now brought with it challenges as well as blessings. One would have to rest from all their work and count on only the provision of God. Same thing with Pentecost. Same thing. See, we have to lay down all of our works. We have to depend on the blood of Yeshua to provide for us. But the challenge was that on the 50-year Jubilee, those who were rich, those who owned land once owned by others, had to return it to the original owner. On Pentecost, we find that we have to return all that we have to the original owner, God. All that we have becomes his. We become spiritual paupers on that day. Now, let me point out something that may not have occurred to you yet. The way this plan of Jubilee is laid out, there would have been two sabbatical years in a row every 50 years. Think about that for a minute. The 49th year was a sabbatical year, final year of each seven-year cycle was a sabbatical year. Then the 50th year, the Jubilee, was another Sabbath year. So you have two Sabbath years in a row. Now, there's been a lot of controversy about this issue. It's been suggested by some rabbis and sages that the way the 50 years was to be counted was the Jubilee year itself was to be counted as year one of the 50-year cycle. Therefore, the first year of the first seven-year period following a Jubilee was actually the second year of the 50-year Jubilee cycle. By suggesting that formula, then, The last year of the seven-year cycle was the Jubilee. That made the seventh-year Sabbath coincide with the 50th-year Jubilee. Why did they come up with that? Because these sages didn't see how it was possible for God to require the people to survive without planting and harvesting for two consecutive years, resulting from two consecutive Sabbath years, the 49th Sabbath year, the 50th Jubilee. But the wording of the Torah is plain, and that idea is just not supported. Indeed, there were to be two consecutive Sabbath years. Now, just put that away for the time being. So let's turn our attention now to verse 10. There's this short statement that kind of flies right by us, that in reality is the whole heart of the matter for Jubilee. It says this: you are to consecrate the 50th year by proclaiming freedom throughout the land. In other versions, it'll say proclaim liberty throughout the land. A couple more versions will say proclaim release throughout the land. The word we want to look at is the one that is translated as freedom or liberty or release, and that word is deror. Now, this word, deror, is important because it's the nucleus of the entire purpose of the Jubilee, because it is declaring for us just exactly what it's all about. Up until very recently, it has been generally agreed by Jewish and Christian scholars alike that freedom and liberty were acceptable English translations for deror. But with the current better understanding of what is called the Hebrew cognates that are found in the Akkadian language, we've arrived at a lot more precise meaning for that term. By way of reminder now, Akkadian is the precursor language to Biblical Hebrew. In other words, Biblical Hebrew grew out of the Akkadian language. And we have vast amounts of ancient records written in Akkadian that is kind of a Rosetta Stone that helps us to translate Biblical Hebrew in modern day to modern day words. Let me also remind you that though similar, Biblical Hebrew is not exactly the same as modern Hebrew. We have a Hebrew teacher here, and she knows that. So we have many Hebrew words in the Bible that are no longer used in modern spoken Hebrew. We also have some Hebrew words whose use is so rare in the Bible that the meaning of the word is kind of fuzzy, kind of hard to translate. Deror is one of those words. But now, within the last few years, we understand it better. And the meaning of it is release. Deror comes from the Akkadian word anduraru. It was a legal term, and it usually was employed when a new king would come into power. And he would declare complete forgiveness of debts and release of indentured servants from their master. A form of that word was also used that meant to move about freely. So freedom and liberty kind of missed the point. Deror more corresponds to the concept of opening your hand and releasing something, specifically being released from bondage and from debt. So far, we have a picture of Jubilee then. That is first the second sabbatical year in a row for the Israelites that happens twice per century, in which they're prohibited from sowing, planting, or harvesting new grain, even from tending their grapevines. They can't even tend their all-important olive trees. And second, Jubilee is to be a year of release from your debts, from your indentured servitude. Third, the only food that could be eaten, whether by animals or men, was that which was stored away in preparation for this difficult two-year span. The only other food that could be eaten is what comes up from the ground on its own. Now we get another phrase whose meaning comes into better focus as we understand the release aspect of Jubilee. Verse 13 ends with the words, every one of you is to return to the land he owns. Or better translated, which most Bibles have, is the land of your possession. I hope you're all starting to follow this, because this is not a trivial matter. This sets the stage for a lot of what we're going to eventually be told in the New Testament. The idea of every man returning to his land is that at some point, the reason a man was not on the land he owned is that it had been sold to somebody else, very probably forfeited to pay a debt. Most times that land was transferred from one person to another, it was because of an unpaid debt. So let me be clear. The Hebrew principle of achuzah was that technically nobody owned the land. They leased it. God was the owner. Even in the covenant with Abraham, there was never a transfer of ownership. The same principle is, of course, moved on down the food chain, whereby a land owner doesn't really own the land, he holds the land, with the idea being he holds it as long as an owner allows him to hold. Who's the owner? God. If the holder of the land uses the land as collateral on a debt, but he can't pay the debt, then the land holding is transferred to the one who was holding the debt. But that person didn't own the land. He was just holding the land. The obvious question comes then, just how long does that person who currently holds the land, how long does he get to hold it? The answer is, until the Jubilee year arrives. That's the ending point. Upon the year of Jubilee, a man who obtained a piece of land by foreclosure had to give that land back to the original owner. Or, if the original owner had died, the new owner had to give it back to the original owner's family or clan. The original owner was not required to pay a thing to get it back under this arrangement of Jubilee. Well, verses now 14 through 22 explain just a little bit further how this deal was to work. So let's look at that, starting verse 14 going to 22. If you sell anything to your neighbor or buy anything from him, neither of you is to exploit the other. Rather, you are to take into account the number of years after the Jubilee when you buy land from your neighbor and he's to sell you according to the number of years crops will be raised. If the number of years remaining is large, you raise the price. If the few years remain, you lower it, because what he is really selling to you is the number of crops to be produced. Thus, you are not to take advantage of each other. You are to fear your God, for I am Adonai. Rather, you are to keep my regulations and rulings and act accordingly, and if you do, you'll live securely in the land. The land will yield its produce. You'll eat it until you have enough. You'll live there securely. And if you ask, if we aren't allowed to sow seed or harvest what our land produces, what are we going to eat in the seventh year? Then I'll order my blessing on you during the sixth year, so that the land brings forth enough produce for all 3 years. The eighth year you will sow seed, but eat the old, stored produce until the ninth year. That is, until the produce of the eighth year comes in, you'll eat the old, stored food. Okay, here's the picture. The foundational principle, the property ownership operates under in the Bible, is the system of law that God is giving to the Hebrews through Moses. And it is that the maximum amount of time anyone who holds land can lose it by any means to another person is 49 years. If that person or family has lost their land to another, or sold it, so to speak, they get it back in the year of Jubilee. This is so vastly different than the Western system of property rights, I think it's kind of hard for us to comprehend. In America, property ownership is considered a sacred right. It's not just held, it's yours. It's yours. If you have a debt on it, a mortgage, and the debt holder forecloses on it, and you can't quickly make good the debt, you lose that property, you lose it forever. It now belongs to the new owner as long as they want to hold it. You don't have any rights. to that property anymore. The new owner has all the rights. He can keep it. He can sell it to somebody. He can will it to the next generation. Not just to use, but to own. This is not the biblical way. This is not the biblical system. I'm not, by the way, finding fault with our system. I'm just trying to explain it's different than what we do. Therefore, under the system we're reading about here in the Torah, what a person paid to acquire a piece of land from someone was based on two things. First, how many years he'd have possession of it until the Jubilee year came. Second, what was the value of the crops that could be grown on that land over that amount of time? So to be clear, if a person acquired a piece of land in the first year after the Jubilee year, then he could hold it for the maximum possible amount of time, 49 years. Therefore, if it was calculated that he would receive 49 years of crops off of it, really it's only 42, because there would be 7 sabbatical years included in all of that, which he couldn't plant or harvest. So now we have an illustration. If each of those 49 years of crops was worth $100, he'd pay the former holder $4,900 for the right to hold the land. On the 50th year, the land reverted to the former owner, and it stayed his unless he lost it again. On the other hand, if several years had passed since the last Jubilee, and the next Jubilee would arrive in, say, 14 years, and a person wanted to obtain that same plot of land, then calculating the value of each year's crops at $100, he'd only pay $1,400 for the land, because he's going to be giving it back a whole lot sooner, and he would have less use of it. For the poor, and for those in debt, man, Jubilee was neat. Can't wait. Now for the wealthy, for the fortunate, they didn't look forward to this. The Jubilee for them represented nothing but loss. Loss of some of their wealth. But the thing both rich and poor shared in common was that for a 2-year period, fresh produce was pretty hard to come by, and its quality was usually poor because it consisted of inferior second and third cuttings of the last harvest. Now, of course, as you can imagine, the wealthier solved this problem simply by purchasing produce from foreign merchants who brought food grown from outside of Israel. Now, verse 18 represents a sudden interruption in these series of ordinances. And abruptly God says this, "You shall observe my laws and can keep them faithfully that you may live upon this land securely." And verse 19 continues the same thought with, "The land will yield its fruit and you shall eat your fill and you shall live upon it securely." History proves the completely and astonishingly accurate playing out of this statement. During the days Israel at least made an attempt to walk in the ways of God, the land was miraculously productive. During the days Israel was in the land in Bible times, it was the breadbasket of the Middle East. Its produce was renowned for its quality and its quantity. Babylonian, Persian, Roman records all show how much these conquerors wanted to have the benefit of the fabulous fruits and grains and vegetables produced in the Holy Lands. But every time the Israelites were exiled, the land stopped producing. When the Assyrians emptied the northern kingdom of Ephraim, Israel, replaced them with foreigners, then later on the Jews of Judah were hauled off to Babylon, immediately the land went into distress. Many years later, we read of Jews returning from their captivity in Babylon to what? Ruined fields, untended vineyards, and a destroyed Jerusalem. Over the centuries, after the destruction of the temple by the Romans in 70 AD and the expulsion of the bulk of the Jewish people from the land, it began a steady decline that corresponded with even greater foreign presence and control and less Hebrew presence and control. Eventually, Israel became a very lightly populated place because the land had just become waste. History books are full of descriptions of visitors to the Holy Lands in the 18th, 19th, and early 20th centuries, where after traveling the land from one end to the other, they were shocked to even understand how anybody could survive in this place. During an 1867 visit to Palestine, the famous Mark Twain observed this. Of all the lands there are for dismal scenery, Palestine must be the prince of it. The hills are barren and dull, the valleys unsightly deserts inhabited by swarms of beggars with ghastly sores and malformations. Palestine sits in sackcloth and ashes. And to this he added that the Holy Lands were now a desolate country whose soil is rich enough, but it's given over wholly to weeds. A silent, mournful expanse, a desolation is here that not even imagination can grace with the pomp of life and action. We reached Tabor safely, but we never saw a human being on the whole route. There was hardly a tree or a shrub anywhere. Even the olives and the cactus, those fast friends of worthless soil, had almost deserted the country. George Adam Smith, a geographer who visited Palestine in 1830, before the changes made by European Jewish immigrants, he described the country as a mixture of barren, treeless lands and malarial, weed-grown swamps. He says Jews who bought this worthless land were called children of death because many of them just didn't survive. When Israel is not in the land responds by going fallow. We're going to continue this next week.
Help support God's people by purchasing items made by them. Merchandise with a meaning. Products with a purpose. HolyLandMarketplace.com. For more teachings, visit, support, or donate at TorahClass.com. Join with us in worship and enjoy God's Word at Seat of Abraham Fellowship.